Peace be upon you. God willing, today we're going to talk about the Quran and a criminal justice system. So, what's the criminal justice system that God advocates in the Quran? So, inshallah, we're going to look at some of the verses and try to get a better understanding of this, and inshallah, all learn in the process. So, in the last podcast, we discussed this concept that, in essence, people are free to do whatever they want as long as they don't harm or victimize anyone else. And, what does it mean to victimize someone else? And we kind of touched on that. We looked at the example of a someone who, has a home, and then next to their home, someone wants to open up a liquor store. And they say, hey, this is my property. I'm free to do whatever I want. But obviously, they're victimizing that family with the clientele, the hours, the noise, all the downsides that come with having such an establishment next to one's home. And the Quran actually specifies there's specific crimes that are mentioned in the Quran and what the corresponding punishments are for those crimes. And they're all governed by one basic fundamental rule, and that's the rule of equivalence, meaning that you cannot institute a punishment to a crime that isn't equivalent to the crime that was committed. So what does that mean? Let's take the example of a thief, and a thief who steals $1,000 from an individual. In this society, what happens under those contexts is that the thief is thrown into prison. But you have to ask, is this an equivalent punishment for the crime? Because what if the thief had a wife or a child, and that individual was the bread earner of that family? What was the crime of the child and the wife to basically be deprived of their bread earner, their father figure? Is that an equitable punishment? Because now, in essence, the people who are suffering are those individuals. Or think about the prison system as a whole. The thief, he gets thrown into prison for God knows how long in an environment where basically, violence and drugs and, rape and all these horrendous things are prevalent. Does that really make that thief, in essence, a better human being? Because at some point, they have to be brought back into society. So the Quran solves this problem by using this very rule of equivalence, this law of equivalence. And in a Quranic justice system, the thief who is convicted of stealing $1,000 from an individual has to work for you to basically pay you back that money, plus any damages or inconveniences that it caused you for losing that $1,000. So if you had to take them to court, if you missed a flight, God knows what, because of this, the thief has to compensate you for that. And in this system now, basically, the thief pays you back the money, right? It's a deterrent from future thieves from basically committing the crime. And then the family and the dependents of that thief aren't deprived of their individual. And that thief, in essence, isn't going to be put into a situation where they're going to be worse off, right? Surrounded by other offenders, convicts, and, in essence, be brought up to be a worse individual when they leave the prison system. So let's just look at the prison system. The prison system, according to the Quran, it's an inhumane punishment, and it's proven to be absolutely useless. And you can look at some of the statistics just in the U.S. as far as the prison system and the outcome of it. So according to the U.S. Bureau of Justice statistics, there's about 2.26 million adults incarcerated in the U.S. federal, state, and county jails as of 2011. And that's about 1% of the adult population is currently incarcerated, right? That's pretty insane in itself to think 1 out of 100 individuals in the United States are in the prison system. And the average cost to hold one individual in prison for 1 year is somewhere between $30,000 to $60,000. So let's say on average it's $45,000, right? Kind of in the middle. And if you times this by the number of individuals in prison, that makes the prison budget about $100 billion a year. Now, think of that, the repercussions to society for having to spend so much to put people inside a system that's going to leave them worse off and not, in essence, into a better situation than what got them there to start. The average university, you talk about the most elite universities, the tuition's about, $30,000 to $45,000. We could send literally 1% of the population, about 3 million children to university for the same price rather than sending these individuals to prison, where they end up being repeat offenders and end up coming out worse off than they were when they went in. And what do we gain as a society? You know, you put an individual inside basically a cell where the threat of violence, the threat of rape, the threat of drug abuse, all this has become prevalent. And in addition, you're surrounding them with other individuals who basically are going to foster that mentality of committing crimes, being a bad citizen. And we don't gain anything from that. And it's interesting, God gives us actually a recommendation to how to treat people who are in prison. In this case, it's captives, and this is in regards typically to the captives of, during the time of war, but it sets a good precedent, and it's in chapter 76, verse 8. It says, they donate their favorite food to the poor, the orphan, and the captive. Now you think of this, it says they donate their favorite food. What's your favorite dish? And it's giving this to the captive, the person who's incarcerated. And you have to ask yourself why. Most often than not, the people in the prison system, it's like, yeah, they have their flaws. Yeah, they had their bad uprising. But at the same time, they have this chip on their shoulder towards society. And they think that everyone is out against them. And when they see an act of kindness, right, if this is the mentality, you can say with certainty that this is going to be better for them than the sense of, say, for instance, this continuous punishment. Now, when people think of prison, they always associate it with these violent offenders, right? The murderers, the rapists, child molesters, this and that. But actually, you know, the bulk of the prison population are people who are in there for nonviolent crimes. And one of the most prevalent is a drug offense. Now, the Quran consistently prohibits intoxicants, be it alcohol, be it marijuana, heroin, whatever, anything that intoxicates the mind, that covers the mind. But this isn't something that the just retribution for someone who chooses to basically harm their own body should be that they should be thrown into prison with, under those circumstances. So let's look at some of the statistics. So between 2001 and 2013, in federal prisons, more than half the prison serving sentences of more than a year in federal facilities were convicted of drug offenses. On September 30, 2013, there was about 100,000 inmates. So 51% of the federal prison population were in prison because of possession, trafficking, or drug-related crimes. So half the population in the federal system is because of drug-related crimes. In the state, drug offenders comprise about 16% of the total state population, and 25% of female prisoners are serving time. So these were just male serving time because of drug offenses. And think of how many of those individuals are, mothers, fathers that can't be with their child. And the child is being, in essence, suffering from that consequence. So what's the cost effectiveness of prison versus treatment? So treatment delivered in the community is one of the most effective ways to prevent such crimes and costs approximately $20,000 less than incarceration per person per year. So you think about this, it's just the money we would be saving treating people who are drug abusers versus throwing them in prison. We would be saving about $20,000 per individual, and we leave them in a state where they're better off than when they entered the system, which is huge, because at the end of the day, I mean, the objective is to have people in a society who function, who respect one another, who respect each other's property, and putting them in a system where, in essence, they're not going to ever be able to be rehabilitated onto society is a drag to the entire society. So a study by Washington State Institute for Public Policy found that every dollar spent on drug treatment in a community yields over $18 in cost savings related to the crime. So every dollar spent, in essence, for treatment for drug abuse, saved $18. So that's an 18-to-1 ratio that you'd be saving just by putting more of that funds into treatment rather than, imprisonment. In comparison, prisons only yield about 37 cents in public safety benefit per dollar spent. So for each dollar put into prison, you're basically reducing about 37 cents worth of crimes within the society. Releasing people to supervision and making treatments accessible is an effective way of reducing problematic drug use, reducing crime associated with drug use, and reducing the number of people in prison. U.S. drug prisoners, the United States incarcerates more people for drug offenses than any other country. With an estimated 6.8 million Americans struggling with drug abuse or dependence, the growth of the prison population continues to be driven largely by incarceration for drug offenses. So these are just some stats. It's from drugwarfacts.org. And you can tell, like, this is kind of further proof that, look, God condemns intoxicants in the Quran. Chapter 5, verse 90 says it very clearly that they calls it abominations of the devil. But the thought that we could just pass a law and say drugs are illegal and all of a sudden people will stop doing drugs is absurd. You look at the billions of dollars that were spent on this war, on the drug war, you know, and how effective was it, right? Drugs are more prevalent now than they've been ever, more easily to be accessed than ever. And yet all these billions of dollars, all these lives that have been ruined because we want to basically enforce morality on the people, it doesn't work that way. People have to come to those conclusions themselves. And if you want to be effective, you need to give people the treatment, the knowledge, the basically understanding and the ways out to get out of that that slippery slope. So, you know, obviously, you know, if someone is, they're under the influence of drugs, be it alcohol, God knows what, and they commit a crime, they're still responsible. The thing is, it's just like alcohol where you punish the crime and not the damage that they do to themselves. So, you know, God willing, if people basically embrace this, eventually society gets to a point where people choose not to do drugs, not because they can't get access to them, because they don't want to. Think about this. Ask the average person, do you want to do heroin? Right? The average person is going to say, no, it's not about accessibility. It's about common sense. And we need to, in essence, empower people to make the common sense decisions. Now, the ones who do fall down that path, it's essential to get them the help, the treatment they need to get them back to a sustainable path. Because not only are they better off, but society as a whole is better off. You think about if that individual who has a drug abuse problem has children, you know, has a spouses, siblings, obviously a mother, father, all those benefit from them being on a straight path. So let's continue on. So basically, the fundamental law is equivalence. The criminal justice system today is far from the law of equivalence. It's about punishment. It's about retribution. And it doesn't do us as a society any good. One of the punishments that's specifically mentioned in the Quran is that of stealing. Contrary to popular belief, what's associated with traditional Muslims is that the thought is, if you steal something, you sever their hands. This is a satanic principle. And it's really, it's quite sad that this is what's instituted in Muslim countries, because the Quran tells the exact opposite. And thank God for God's mathematical proof and for sending a messenger. It's clarified for us. And the chapter that speaks of basically marking of a thief's hand is in 538. So it reads, the thief, male or female, you shall mark their hands as a punishment for their crime and to serve as an example from God. God is almighty, most wise. So it's interesting. So this is chapter 5, verse 38. If you add 538 is equal to 43, right? So where else is this word mark used in the Quran? And it's actually used in the chapter 12, verse 31, where it's talking about the governor's wife when she was in love with Joseph. So what the governor's wife did was she invited her friends over who were basically gossiping about her feelings towards Joseph, and she gave each of them a knife, a sharp knife. And then she asked Joseph to come into the room. And when they came, Joseph came in the room, they were so admired by his good looks that they basically cut their hands. Now, obviously, they didn't sever their hands, right? The knife slipped, they were, you know, basically preparing a meal, and the knife slips, and they cut their hands. And this is proof that this verse, when it's 538, is not sever. It's a completely different Arabic word than what it means to cut, or in this case, mark. And what else is interesting, so 5 plus 38 is 43, and so is 12 plus 31. So chapter 12, verse 31, where it talks about the women who cut their hands, is also equals 43. And this is further mathematical proof that these two verses are related, and that the punishment for a thief is not to sever their hands, but to mark their hands. Now, what does it mean to mark their hands? One other point is that 19 verses later, in chapter 12, verse 50, it says the king said, bring him to me. It's referring to Joseph from prison. When the messenger came to him, he said, go back to your lord and ask him to investigate the women who cut their hands. My lord is fully aware of their schemes. So again, you know, this is 19 verses later. Again, the same Arabic word, and the word means to cut or to mark. So what does it mean to cut or mark someone's hand? In essence, if you look at the verse, it says it right there. It says, as a punishment for the crime and to serve as an example from God. The basic punishment is the fact of letting society know that this individual is a thief, and to put social pressure on that individual and other people who are thinking about stealing not to go down that path. And this is a common theme in the Quran, is this aspect of social pressure, that when people have the highest level of morality, that they will instill it inside the society and people will act moral on their own accord. And marking their hand, some people are instituting this as fingerprinting. Other people think in the sense of just, you know, having a mark on their hand so people know for some time that this person was basically convicted of stealing. It serves as a deterrent for the individual and the public as a whole to basically not go down the path to steal. So another punishment that's specifically instituted in the Quran for a crime is the punishment for adultery. So it's very interesting, again, another satanic practice that's used by traditional Muslims in Iran, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, is that when someone commits adultery, the punishment they do is stoning. Like, how horrendous, disgusting of an act that they will bury someone from basically the neck down and then throw stones at them until they die. Other aspects, like in Afghanistan and Pakistan, they do honor killing. Like, where do they get this from? This is by no means, you see consistently in the Quran that the only people who stone are the disbelievers. It's pretty funny when you look at that people, traditional Muslims, are instituting something that is consistently attributed to the disbelievers, this concept of stoning someone to death. In 24:2, it reads what the punishment for adulteress is. It says, the adulteress and adulterer, you shall whip each of them 100 lashes. Do not be swayed by pity from carrying out God's law if you truly believe in God in the last day. And let a group of believers witness their penalty. So we read in the footnote that basically social pressure, for example, public witnessing of the penalty is the basic punishment. See also 538. The lashes shall be symbolic, not severe. And this is actually also used in chapter 33, where it says they whip you with sharp tongues, right? This isn't in the sense of to leave someone debilitated, badly harmed. It's just the sense of basically making this into a public exposure to discourage the behavior. Now, it continues on. I'm gonna jump ahead. Why is this act of adultery so heavily that God sets this aside from other punishments and says, hey, the couple that commits adultery, you have to, in essence, punish them, that there has to be a public witnessing of the crime to basically serve as a deterrent for them in future generations? Now, there's something very specific that everyone knows what happens when adultery is committed. When adultery is committed, and again, this is just to define adultery, it's basically sexual relations between a man and a woman outside of marriage. It doesn't matter that if it's, say, before they got married, or in the sense if, you know, someone's married and they cheat on their spouse, that's adultery, and we can look at the verses. But one thing that happens in the act of adultery is the fact that you have the possibility of creating another life. And that in itself is a huge responsibility. Now, if someone is going around, in essence, taking that lighthearted, in the sense that they think that, oh, they can commit adultery and not worry about the consequences, not just to the offspring, but to society as a whole, is victimizing not only that child, but the entire society. Now, you can look at all the statistics that's associated with basically having children outside of wedlock and what happens to society. So here's just some numbers. So children from single-parent households, right? So these are predominantly people who had a child outside of wedlock, and then, you know, basically the father and the mother, they bounced. And 63% of all youth suicides come from single-parent households. 70% of all teenage pregnancies come from single-parent households. 71% of all adolescent chemical substance abuse, so drug abuse, originate from people from a single-parent household. 80% of the prison inmates come from a single-parent household. 90% of all homeless and runaway children, 90% is because they didn't have both a mother and a father in their home, right? And this is predominantly 85% of single-parent households were from children who basically were conceived outside of wedlock. And let's continue. 75% of teenage pregnancies are from single-parent households. 63% of youth suicides are from fatherless homes. 85% of all children that exhibit behavioral disorders come from fatherless homes. Now, you know, more often than not, it's the father that leaves, right? Because the mother is the one who basically has to bear the child, who ends up raising the child, and the father, in essence, abandons his responsibilities. And this is absolutely detrimental to a society. Let's continue. 80% of rapists motivated with displaced anger comes from fatherless homes. 71% of all high school dropouts come from fatherless homes. 70% of all juveniles in state-operated institutions come from fatherless homes. 85% of all youth sitting in prison grew up in fatherless homes, right? So fatherless homes, you're 5 times more likely to commit suicide, 32 times more likely to run away, 20 times more likely to have behavioral disorders, 14 times more likely to commit rape, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, 10 times more likely to abuse drugs, 9 times more likely to end up in operated institutions, and 20 times more likely to end up in prison. Now, you think of this, why is it that God isolates this crime, this act of adultery, so heavily to the point that he's advocating society to put social pressure on individuals who commit this act? It's because when this act happens, what happens is that that child is being victimized because they're not going to, all the statistics are already basically stacked up against them, that the likeliness of them being able to be productive, successful individuals is drastically diminished. Now, this isn't to say that this is the case for every single human being, because obviously there's plenty and plenty of examples of individuals who grew up, you know, basically who were conceived outside of wedlock, grew up in a single-parent household, and yet ended up being very successful. But the odds of that happening are stacked so heavily against them. And this ends up being a major, issue for the child who's being victimized, and then society. You think about, you know, just looking at the prison population, right? 80% of all prison inmates came from single-parent households. And that burden that's put on society, so if the total bill for prison population is $100 billion a year, that means $80 billion of that is because the child was conceived outside of wedlock and ended up in the prison system that we're all as a society paying for. And this isn't something to be taken lightly. This is something that, you know, in essence, in a submitting society, we as a society should have the highest moral integrity. And one of the most critical pieces of this is this concept that you keep yourself 100% committed to your spouse after marriage. Right, that you're not, in essence, going out having multiple partners prior to marriage, or even, you know, during marriage for some individuals, because this ends up being such a huge burden to society. Now, I'm going to jump ahead to one of the other outcomes in regards to abortion. So I'm kind of jumping around, but I think it's going to work out better. So obviously, one of the outcomes of adultery is having a child outside of wedlock is the idea that, hey, let's just abort this child because, you know, it wasn't intended. They didn't have the intention of having a child, and it's going to be a major burden. So they basically decide to abort. And abortion in the Quran is absolutely condemned. It's basically considered murder. Now, the thing is, again, What do you do to someone? It's not like you can pass a law and all of a sudden abortion stops. You look at societies that ban abortion, and abortion is more prevalent there than anywhere else in the world. And the concept is the fact that God advocates in the Quran not to commit abortion. And in 1731, it reads, "You shall not kill your children due to fear of poverty. We provide for them as well as for you. Killing them is a gross offense." 6151 say, "Come, let me tell you what your Lord has really prohibited for you. You shall not set up idols besides him. You shall honor your parents. You shall not kill your children for fear of poverty. We provide for you and for them. You shall not commit gross sins, obvious or hidden. You shall not kill. God has made life sacred, except in the course of justice. These are his commandments to you that you may understand." So let's look at some of the statistics around abortion. In 2011, approximately 1.06 million abortions took place in the United States, and that's just the ones that are recorded. From 1973 through 2011, 53 million legal abortions have occurred in the United States. In 2010, unmarried women accounted for 85% of all abortions. In 2010, women who had not aborted in the past accounted for 55.6% of all abortions. Women with one or two prior abortions accounted for 36.7%, and women with three or more prior abortions accounted for 7.7%. So roughly half the women who commit abortion are likely to commit multiple abortions. And in essence, I mean, it's the literal death of a child. The abortion rate of women with medical coverage is three times as high as that of other women. So again, this has to kind of do with responsibility. And God willing, we can talk about this in a future podcast in regards to economic incentives according to the Quran. And let's continue. So on average, women give at least three reasons for choosing abortions. So three out of four say that having a baby would interfere with work, school, or other responsibilities. About three-fourths say they cannot afford a child, and half say they do not want to be a single parent or having problems with their husbands or partner. So you see consistently, it's like committing adultery, 85% chance that if a baby is conceived during that time, it's going to lead to an abortion. And if it leads to abortion, there's about a 50% probability that it's going to be a continued act, that this isn't going to be a one-off incident. And the thing is, literally, you're talking about millions and millions of babies who are being killed. When there's people out there, you think about it, who are dying to have a child, who would give so much to have a child. And these children are being killed before they ever have a chance. And the whole concept of the Quran is you're not allowed to victimize someone else. You're free to do whatever you want as long as you don't victimize someone else. And when you commit an abortion, you're victimizing that future child. And if you think about it, it's like, yeah, are they going to have an hard uprising? Absolutely. But you think about how many people, given the chance at a living life to say, hey, you can end your life now, would they choose to do that, right? Obviously, I mean, we read in the Quran, suicide's prohibited. But you think about it, people, when they're living, would never want to give anything up to stop living. And it's not fair. There's an awesome documentary from the daughter of Martin Luther King Jr. I'm drawing a blank on what the name was, but it's looking at just how horrendous of an act abortion is. But abortion is something that you cannot, again, legislate and expect it to stop. The society as a whole has to have the highest level of moral integrity to, one, not commit adultery, and then ideally not commit abortion. So murder, you know, this brings us to the next point. And it's the third point in the Quran where there's a specific punishment associated with murder. And abortion is murder, but it's interesting. You'd be surprised as far as how this plays out. So God actually in the Quran, when it discusses murder, discourages capital punishment and tries to make every excuse not to take the life of the individual. And in chapter 2, 178, it says, discouraging capital punishment. O you who believe, equivalence is a law decreed for you when dealing with murder. The free for the free, the slave for the slave, the female for the female. If one is pardoned by the victim's kin, an appreciative response is in order, and an equitable compensation shall be paid. This is an alleviation from your Lord and mercy. Anyone who transgresses beyond this incurs a painful retribution. 2179. Equivalence is a life-saving law for you. O you who possess intelligence, that you may be righteous. So God is saying the victim's family can basically pardon the murderer, and advocates that if they do, that basically an equitable compensation shall be paid. And also we see in other verses that when someone forgives a crime, that they get a ton of reward from God for doing that. So you have to ask yourself, so let's look at this example of abortion. Someone kills their own child. The victim's kin, so the family, dictates the outcome of that, what happens to that individual. So under these contexts, it's like, well, the mother's the one who took the life. She would be the one, as far as one of the people, who determines what the equitable compensation should be. You know, and you can say, yeah, it's the victim's family, potentially the father, you know, the grandparents or something of that accord. But I can't imagine anyone under those contexts would want to punish the individual outside of just, again, social pressure and trying to convince them that this is not the right route. The footnote of 2178 says the Quran clearly discourages capital punishment. Every kind of excuse is provided to spare lives, including the life of the murderer. The victim's kin may find it better under certain circumstances to spare the life of the murderer in exchange for an equitable compensation. And it's so powerful because if you go, again, you look at the, you know, a lot of these Islamic countries, they have the worst statistics for murdering and capital punishment. And one of the things, like, here's another excuse that God creates. It says, in the verse, it says, the free for the free, the slave for the slave, the female for the female. Due to human meanness and injustice, many people cannot even imagine what the Quranic law says. They refuse to accept the clear injunctions, and strict equivalence must be observed. If a woman kills a man, or a man kills a woman, or a slave kills a free person, or a free person kills a slave, capital punishment cannot be applied. The Quran prefers that the murderer compensate the victim's family. Killing the murderer does not bring the victim back, nor does the family of the victim benefit from executing the murderer. The compensation, however, must be sufficient to be a deterrent for others. In submission, the victim and or victim's family are the judges for all the crimes, and they decide what the punishment shall be under the supervision of a person who knows the Quran. And again, you see this constant theme of equivalence. And God highly, highly discourages capital punishment. Now, the victim's family might decide, yeah, that capital punishment is the route they want to go. And if it falls under the context of these verses in the Quran, they're allowed to make that decision. But God gives every excuse not to do that. And an example of this is in 532. It says, the grossness of murder. It says, because of this, we decreed for the children of Israel that anyone who murders any person who had not committed murder or horrendous crimes, it shall be as if he murdered all the people. And anyone who spares a life, it shall be as if he spared the lives of all the people. Our messengers went to them with clear proofs and revelations, but most of them, after all this, are still transgressing. Now, how awesome is this? Is this anyone who murders any person who had not committed murder or horrendous crimes, it shall be as if he murdered all the people, right? So in this this sentence, it's saying, you know, if basically if someone murders someone unjustly, it's the equivalent of if he murdered every single individual on this planet. And then in the flip side, it says, as anyone spares a life, and it's not limiting this life to a life of a righteous person. It says anyone who spares a life, period, it shall be as if he spared the lives of all the people. So the victim's family, who basically were robbed during this altercation of their loved one, if they choose to spare that individual's life, it's as if they spared the lives of all the people. Now you can imagine the amount of credit one individual can receive from being able to carry out such a tough act after losing a loved one through such a horrendous act of murder. But this is what God advocates in the Quran. And again, just to summarize, there's three crimes that God talks about in the Quran that has delegates punishments. And one of that is thief, basically stealing, adultery, and murder. And just to recap, in regards to all these, equivalence is the law, meaning you cannot dole out a punishment that's greater than the crime that's committed. And you want to basically limit that the punishment is limited to the individual who committed that crime and not society and not the family of the individual. And again, when it comes to murder, capital punishment, God gives every excuse to spare that individual's life. And God willing, I mean, if we can apply these principles, we can be better as a society. And the whole aspect is we work on ourselves, that if we instill in ourselves, in our children, in our loved ones, the highest level of moral integrity, we all benefit as society. Now, we have this concept that we think that, oh, laws need to be on the books for them to be carried out. But we see it with the drug wars. We see it with abortion. It's irrespective if a law's on the books or not. Individuals have to grow spiritually, mentally, physiologically, to the point of realizing that we need to have the highest level of moral integrity. And until we do that, there's nothing we can do as a society to legislate this. All these laws that are in the Quran, basically, they go down to the laws of social pressure and basically people, in essence, governing themselves. And it's something not to be taken lightly. God willing, you know, we got to look a lot deeper into this. There's so much information there. I was just trying to scratch the surface. God forgive me if I said anything wrong, and grow our understanding and guide the believers to the correct understanding. Until next time, peace and God bless. And also, if you guys got any comments, questions, send them over to QuranTalk@gmail.com. And until next time, peace and God bless.